Stay tuned. We've got a pre-recorded interview with U.S. Senator Mitt Romney coming up. Later on, Mo Hickey, Voices for Utah Children, will also be joined by one of his policy analysts. We'll be talking about the DACA ruling. And finally, Communities That Care Executive Director Mary Krista Smith has details on being awarded a highly competitive drug-free communities grant by the CDC. Stay tuned. Well, last week, U.S. Senator Mitt Romney spoke with KPCW's Carolyn Murray. He had a wrap-up of a year like no other. He discussed his views on the election, the transfer of power, immigration, and some of his legislative initiatives. We began by asking Senator Romney who he believes won the presidency in November's election.
There's no question Joe Biden is the president-elect of the country, that he won this election. There were surely irregularities, as there always are in an election, but there were not sufficient regularities to suggest a different outcome. And that was evidenced not only by the head of cybersecurity for our government, Chris Krebs, but also by the Attorney General, who has the FBI and other agencies to look into these allegations. It's clear that the president's efforts to diminish the validity of the election as a byproduct, a reduction that people have in confidence in democracy, and that has a high cost for our country and for people around the world. After all, people look to the United States to be the leader of the free world, and if they think we can't hold an election, how are they going to hold it? In a third world country, the president's claims I find to be very unfortunate and frankly dangerous.
So do you think that there's something that could happen from Congress that would preclude this from happening again?
I think there will be an examination of what actions we could take that would make it less likely for authoritarian effort by one party or the other to be successful. Most of the efforts, I think, will have to happen at the state level because under our Constitution, states are responsible for the elections that are held within their borders. And so I think states may have to rethink some of these issues. We've never quite been tested like this. I must admit I'm impressed by the courage of some of these election workers who didn't know what they were getting into by taking on a functionary responsibility to find that they're getting, you know, attacked on all sides. And they stood up and honored their oath and done what they believe is right. I give them extraordinary credit. They have been profiles in courage.
Shifting to some of the legal wrangling that has been going on by the Trump administration, and then, of course, this recent rebuke from the Supreme Court towards Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, along with 17, I believe, other attorney generals, including Utah's Attorney General Sean Reyes, claiming that four states that did swing for Joe Biden should not have their votes counted. What are your thoughts on that? And should there be consequences or repercussions for those attorneys general who participated in this?
Well, the repercussions associated with action that people think is not right is that they get voted out of office, and that may or may not occur. There would not be other action. People are entitled to bring lawsuits forward. Texas and even Attorney General Reyes are certainly able to bring forward a lawsuit. I think it was, in many respects, a frivolous effort. The idea that one state can challenge another state's ability to run its own election is counter to the principle of federalism, which my party has long supported, clearly outside any kind of legal bounds. And I think the Supreme Court did what was entirely predictable, including those individuals that were appointed by President Trump. They likewise felt that this was a cause of action without merit.
So Utah's six electoral votes have gone to Donald Trump in the election. He received more than 58% of the popular vote here in Utah. What are you hearing from your constituents? And there have been some pretty awful things said about you over the past couple of years for speaking out against Donald Trump. Have you had to increase security due to this kind of rhetoric, or how are you faring?
I learned long ago that when you're in the public eye, it's best not to read the comment section or the letters to the editor. So I know that that's the nature of our discourse at the lowest level, and I just have to ignore that. And I let other people worry about those things for me. So I don't put that on the front burner in my daily life.
your concession speech when you ran for president in 2012 was markedly different, notably different from what we are seeing now. And Donald Trump shows no sign of a public concession. What's happening here? And do your colleagues who support this position really believe it and believe the election was stolen? What are you hearing? Is this just political or is it a fear of retribution?
You know, I can't speak for others of my colleagues. I can only speak for myself, and I've expressed my own conviction. I think one also has to recognize, as we see American individuals forming their own opinions, that we're not all seeing the same news. If you're watching certain websites, social media sites, or certain networks, cable networks, and so forth, why what you're seeing is very different than if you're watching other ones. And so, I don't blame people who come to different conclusions, in part because they're seeing, if you will, different facts. I mourn the fact, however, that there is not an effort to go to the most reliable sources where, when they make mistakes, they acknowledge they made mistakes, sources where you know who the people are that are making a comment, and you know that they have editors, and you have determined over time whether they're credible or not. So I think we live in a challenging time, in part because our sources of information are so disparate, and people are inclined to accept as truth things which oftentimes are untrue. And I would note that foreign entities and malevolent players within our own country are intent on misleading the American people and sowing discord, sometimes for financial gain, sometimes for national security gains. It's a troubled development and one we have not determined how to deal with.
And Bill Barr is leaving the administration. What does this mean, and should Americans be concerned about this, brief period of time before the inauguration?
So I don't know that I can say that there's no reason for concern. I saw a comment today that we need a shorter period of time between an election and an inauguration, and there may be some merit to that because it's a long period of time where someone is out of office. I do have confidence in the Justice Department. There are a lot of people there. There are, I think over 10,000 people in the FBI. Don't stay up nights worrying about what may happen in that regard. But I can't say that I'm 100% sanguine.
Let's move on to some things that you've been working on. You have worked this year to create a wildland firefighting commission, and with 1,400 wildland fires here in Utah this year and more than 300,000 acres that have burned, with a very large majority of those fires being human-caused, we've spent like $55 million fighting fires in Utah. Tell us about this bill and what would it do for wildland firefighting efforts?
Well, we start in some respects the way Australia did, which is they've also had, as you know, a extraordinary rash of wildfires, massively destructive, and they said, all right, stage one is to gather experts in the firefighting community, in the political community, but scientists and thinkers beyond just the normal realms, and bring them together in a commission to study what's happening. And obviously climate change is affecting the prevalence of wildfires, and then to consider what kinds of actions we might take to combat the new reality when it comes to wildfires. And so that's what my legislation proposes, which is people in these various communities come together in a commission, study this effort, and come forward with proposals. What I would expect you're going to see is a proposal to dramatically increase funding for heavy lift aircraft that can drop flame retardant on fires. Number two, a much more immediate alarm system to identify wildfires before they become massive conflagrations. And number three, an ability to move federal resources to a fire earlier than we do now. Because as you probably know, in some of our more rural communities, for the first several days, fighting the fire is done by volunteer fire departments, small volunteer fire departments. I mean, we have counties with less than 5,000 people in them. and expecting them to put out massive fires is perhaps a task which is a mismatch. So I would like to see federal resources applied in a much more immediate manner. So those are the kinds of things I expect to come forward, but there may be other ideas that are ones I haven't thought of and that others haven't thought of. So the legislation calls for us to begin with a commission to make a study and to make recommendations and then to appropriate funding necessary to carry out those recommendations.
Let's briefly talk about immigration pathways. Should our country provide opportunities to come here to escape violence or even just to find a better life? Where are you on that? And do you anticipate bipartisan work being done to address immigration challenges?
I do expect there to be an effort to fashion immigration legislation. I don't know whether that will be successful or not, but I do believe that there will be a bipartisan group of senators that address that issue. And my party has traditionally welcomed legal immigration, and there have been various points of view about illegal immigration and how to prevent it or to reduce it. But legal immigration, as well as dealing with refugees from other places of the world, has been part of our heritage, particularly in our state. Our state has been a leader in welcoming people who are suffering. And it's one of the things I think that if will distinguishes us in a very positive way. So I hope that we will be more assertive as a nation in dealing with these issues and think that we're way past time for us to have put together an immigration piece of legislation that resolves some of the uncertainty that so many people who are here today need to have resolved.
Where does the deferred action on childhood arrivals person fit into that conversation? It sounds like there's a reprieve again, but I suppose that could change with a different administration, different challenges in our courts. What should happen to those children who come here under the will of their parents?
Well, this would, of course, be part of the immigration legislation, and so it's not been resolved, I hope that we can get that resolved as part of this effort, but as you know, a can has been kicked down the road for many, many years, and it's time for us to get some resolution.
What about the Defense Authorization Act?
Hill Air Force Base is a critical element. We have a fighter wing there, but there are a number of elements that are in the National Defense Authorization Act my team and I have been fighting for. One is, of course, the additional F-35s, but also protection for the Dugway Proving Ground in Tooele County. I'm also insistent that there be an evaluation of our force level in Germany. I don't think we should be pulling our troops out of Germany. And there have been some elements with regards to hiring talented individuals to work at Hill that is also in this bill. So overall, it's a positive step forward for our state.
Is the Confederate monuments issue reconciled at this point?
I believe the president indicated that he was backed off the threat of veto for Confederate naming of bases.
Can you and Congressman Ben McAdams have worked on legislation somewhat related to the COVID pandemic that would secure clean drinking water for the Navajo Nation? I guess this project, of course, is related to how hard our Navajo community has been hit by this virus. What are the holdups with this?
Well, you're absolutely right. Congressman McAdams and I have worked on a Navajo Water Rights Settlement Act. In this act, the Navajo Nation agrees to give certain water rights that it has to the Colorado back to the state of Utah and the country. And in exchange, we provide about $200 million to build infrastructure to take water to people's homes in the Navajo Nation. About half the people in the Navajo Nation have no running water. This was something which I then took to the Senate, and I have been able to secure a unanimous vote in the Senate to provide these funds and to support this act. It then goes to the House for the House to take action. And Ben McAdams has pushed Speaker Pelosi and others in leadership in the House to support this bill. It has not yet been voted on in the House. I think the reason for that is that there are other House members that say, well, how about other tribes? We want money for our tribe. And that's often what happens in Washington. And as a result, it's been bogged down in the House. And we can only hope that the Democratic leadership of the House will recognize that the Navajo Nation, which has suffered so severely from COVID-19, should certainly have the rights to running water. This is a bill which is very much in the interest of the Navajo Nation and the state of Utah.
That's U.S. Senator Mitt Romney speaking last week with KPCW's Carolyn Murray. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, earlier this month, a New York federal court ordered the Department of Homeland Security to restore DACA to its original form. What does that mean for the thousands who are here in our country under the DACA provisions, as well as those who would like to apply? Mo Hickey has been instrumental in helping those here in Summit and Wasatch County with the DACA process. He also serves as CEO of Voices for Utah Children. He joins me on the phone along with Ciriac Alvarez-Valle, who is a policy analyst for Voices for Utah Children. Good morning to both of you.
Morning, Wesley.
Hi, good morning.
Mo, let's start with you and maybe have you start by explaining the most recent federal court ruling requiring Homeland Security to reinstate DACA, if you would.
Yes, it's about 2 weeks ago now, the federal court reinstated DACA for new applicants, which was a change over the past 2 years, going back to 2017. UCSIS had stopped taking new DACA applications. So for the past 2 years, 2.5 years, the only people that have been allowed to submit anything were renewals of people that were previously approved, which left a big void. Without getting into all the technical parts, DACA was set for a limited period of time as far as age groups. So there was a younger cohort that either had never been allowed to apply or have not had the funds to apply. So now with this new ruling, the federal government is now taking new applications for the first time in 2.5, 3 years.
Okay. So, Ciriac, maybe you can tell us the provisions then of DACA. I mean, this is a very limited group of people who can actually apply, mm-hmm. whether it's to renew or apply for the first time.
Yeah, DACA only represents maybe less than 10% of all undocumented people, and that's because you had to have come before a certain date. It's a day in July of 2007, and you had to be present when President Barack Obama gave the announcement of deferred action back in summer of 2012. You have to have lived continuously during that time period. There's a background check that someone has to go through, fingerprints that someone has to do and redo every single year.
Yeah. So you're, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Oh no, I was just going to say, and then like a lot more, like requirements, like having a JD or going to school or having gone to high school. It's not simple, one, to meet the requirements, and two, to show that you meet the requirements.
So these necessarily aren't children anymore. I mean, they're adults, yeah?
Yeah. The average DACA recipient is 25 or older.
Right. And you're one of...
Leslie, can I add one thing there? What we're finding, and this is going to be a concern both in places like Park City and other schools around the country, the younger cohort, so as Eric said, the average age is 25, but the youngest cohort cutoff date is roughly... falls right in the middle of our senior class this year. So you have some mm-hmm. students in our senior class that can apply for the application or have applied. And then you have another group which now has no recourse. So from our senior class in high schools across the country down right now, anybody who would have fallen into the same status now has no path.
Right. And Ciriac, you're one of those who has benefited from DACA status. Can you talk to us about how it has helped you?
Yeah, I got DACA when I was a senior in high school, actually exactly what Mo was talking about. And because of that, I was able to graduate high school and then get a full-time job and work my way through college and able to graduate back in 2017. And now I work at Voices for Utah Children, and it is thanks to the DACA program. And I'm able to help my family, especially in times of need, like right now. So DACA has been instrumental in my life to be able to move forward. And I know that how big of a difference it's made for me and my family.
Certainly. And it's allowed you to get an education, like you say, and mm-hmm. And work legally. But as mm-hmm. we saw, the rug could be pulled out from under you at any time. Is there any certainty in those like you will have some future path to citizenship?
I have hope and I believe, but right now it seems a little bit more positive now that President Biden won't be constantly attacking the DACA program. And depending on the Senate confirmations or the Senate elections, there may be more hope within the Senate to pass. And 80% of Americans, 80% of people who live here agree that DACA recipients deserve a pathway to citizenship. So all the support is there. We just need someone to champion it.
Yeah, and Mo, any idea what the new administration will do to address the immigration issue?
Well, what we're hearing right now is the first step is going to be they will reinstate the executive order. So we're hoping there may be some tweaks to that to, as I said, maybe expand the younger years, but we're not overly optimistic that'll happen on day one. But, you know, one thing that's important about the history of DACA is that the genesis of what's now known as DACA was the DREAM Act, and that was actually Orrin Hatch and Dick Durbin on a bipartisan legislation going back to 2001. And there's some local history because the first two recipients were Park City High School students who have gone on to lead very extremely productive and professional careers. And we met going back a couple of years ago. Park City Municipal arranged to have people from, at the time, Senator Romney's team, Senator Hatch's team. I'm trying to think who else came up. Representative Bishop had someone come up and meet with us. And universally, everybody thinks this program is the right program. As Syriac said, we just need somebody who's willing to champion it. But I think it has to be bipartisan legislation that will actually put it into the and make it codified so that it stays and it's not subject to executive orders every 2 years or every year.
So we're going on 19 years, right? I mean, since it was first introduced, and I think it was Senator Orrin Hatch, as you mentioned, co-sponsored, but also, and then maybe a year or so later, kind of withdrew that support.
Yeah, it's been a political hot potato, for lack of a better word. You know, everybody, like I said, that we've spoken to, if you really look at Syriac, just mentioned a couple of the requirements for DACA. It's pretty stringent. And I've heard some of their representatives tell us that this should actually be the program that we use to finally come up with a solid immigration policy for the country. You know, you have to go through background checks. You can't have a felony. You can have three misdemeanors maximum, like a driving violations. You have to have a job, be in the military, or be in college. So, you know, it's a fairly straightforward, strict program with biometric screening, fingerprinting. It's time we stop making it a political issue. And the reality is, these are, you know, I've had the opportunity to meet with so many of these students who are now young adults as we've had this program. They are, not only are they productive, almost universally across the board, they're giving back to the community because of the opportunity they've been given. And to me, that's what this program really stands for.
Okay. So, I mean, what's the future of this? I mean, we don't know how long the current ruling will hold, right? I mean, we need to see, as you say, something codified, some action, some bill, some statute passed, in order for things to be certain for these people who have been hung in limbo for, you know, two decades.
I'll let Syriac answer that, and then I'll follow up with it.
in terms of it, I mean, we don't know how long the ruling will last. I mean, what really needs to happen? I mean, so that people aren't just being strung along with no really future in sight.
Yeah, I mean, you can see how much this was a not a permanent protection for Dreamers with all the court litigations that happened these past 4 years. And even today, there could be a decision made in Texas. And so we do need a permanent protection. That means a pathway to citizenship. And there have been several, a lot actually, of different legislations come up throughout the years, and the Dream and Promise Act is one of them. And I think that is one of the best ones that really did try to create compromises, some with the original, like, Gang of Eight folks who worked on immigration bills back in 2001. And I think it also creates an opportunity to move forward on comprehensive and humane immigration reform afterward with that bill.
And Mo?
The thing I'll add on to that, we're a little optimistic in Utah, of all places. And part of that is, you know, the new governor has stepped forward. Well, I give Governor Herbert credit. He had the compact on racial equity last week that they announced, that everybody's treated equally. We have a new governor who actually appointed a senior advisor of equity yesterday, Nubia Pena, from the director of the State Multicultural Commission. There's a groundswell in Utah, and we actually believe that we can get we're hopeful that we can get Senator Romney to be one of the people that takes this forward. It has a history in Utah. It's proven successful in Utah. We've heard from a lot of community members. We're finally starting to hear elected officials. Mayor Mendenhall in Salt Lake City wrote a great op-ed 3 weeks ago, I believe, supporting DACA. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to see some unity coming behind it. As people, the key to me with DACA has been, and I had to learn this a few years ago, is what it is and what it's not. And once people understand what it is, as Syriac mentioned, it's over 80% support nationwide.
Yeah. In terms of the help that you have made over the last several years, Mo, I mean, can you have a number on the number of kids that you've been able to help?
As of last week, we went over 200 kids, so that's over $100,000 directly from private donations only. It started housed at the Park City Ed Foundation, and then we moved it over to Voices when I joined Voices about a year and a half ago. We partner, the reason I say it's over $100,000, we partner with the Mexican consul now. If someone is of Mexican origin, the consul will pay half, and we'll pay half the fee. So the fee is $495. We will pay $250. They will pay $245. If someone is not of Mexican origin, we will pay the whole $495. And again, all private donations. Right now, depending on countries of origin, we have funding for somewhere between 50 and 80 more applicants as of today. Great. So we're still taking requests. If anybody is listening and has interest, we just, to give you an example, we just had four or five requests come directly from the Park City School District, from the community outreach mm-hmm. coordinator. They can reach either Syriac or I at www.utahchildren.org. Both of our emails are there. I do ask people to send emails. It's just easier than having an unknown number popping up on our phones. So if we get an email, we know what it's about, and we can reply with the correct information rapidly.
Okay. And then, Syriac, we should try and get you scheduled for our show, Cada Domingo, and then let people know in Spanish what they can do. In terms of...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, and Mo, in terms of the numbers, the 200, is that just Summit County, or is that Summit and Wasatch County?
It's been Summit County, Wasatch County, and actually we've gone outside the county now because of the funding we received. It's allowed us to go outside of it. So what's been interesting to me is we've had, I think the first 2 weeks we were doing the program going back 4 years ago, we got a couple of requests out of Utah County, and it turns out they were Park City High School students who had graduated and were living in Utah County. So originally we were making a connection with Summit County, but now because, as I said, the funding we received and the partnership with the consul, we've been able to expand outside of Summit County. So we've accepted across the board. We're also partnering right now with the Dream Center at SLIC and the Dream Center at the University of Utah, and they're raising funds to help fund the program. So there's information about that we can share with you as well. If you make a donation, the University of Utah had an artist create a poster, and if you contribute over $25, you'll receive a copy of the poster. And that's just a grassroots movement at the university level and at SLIC to try to help their fellow students. So it's really grown into a lot more than what it was when we first started.
Sure.
In Park City.
So the cost to apply, $495. What's the cost of the renewal? The same price?
Yes, mm-hmm. And it's every 2 years. And that's the challenge. You know, I don't want to sound glib, but a lot of times in Park City, someone will say, $495, that's not much. I can tell you from a lot of the young people that I've talked to, that's the difference for them of paying rent that month or, you know, making a car payment and keeping their job.
Yeah. Any idea how many kids are in the pipeline to apply or renew?
We've just started, Sarah could probably answer a little better, but as of last week, once the ruling came down, the Dream Center started getting hit pretty quickly, like with information, requests mm-hmm. for information. So I don't think we have a definitive number right now, but we think I could say pretty conservatively that the funding we have right now at the moment will go probably by the middle of January.
Okay.
We would get those 40 or 50 kids in pretty quickly.
All right. Anything either of you would like to add?
Nope.
Like I said, if anybody's interested in helping out, we've also had a couple of lawyers from Summit County reach out and Salt Lake who are doing pro bono work for us. That's another thing that's never really talked about in this program. You really have to have help filling out, especially new applicants, because you cannot make a mistake. Any mistake the whole application will be rejected and you lose your fee. The negative side of that is there have been cases where people who are not lawyers are charging exorbitant fees to help people fill out the applications. I heard of one family paid $1,800 in fees to get the two mm-hmm. applications filled out. So we'll be coming back in January with a list of lawyers that will do pro bono help as part of this partnership, because we don't want people to get hit with that fee in addition to the application fee and not be able to afford it.
All right. And then how do they reach you? By email?
By email. It's pretty simple. It's Ciriac, C-I-R-I-A-C, at utahchildren.org, or Moe, M-O-E, at utahchildren.org.
All right. Well, Moe and Ciriac, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Leslie. Happy holidays.
Summit County's Community That Cares organization has received news that they've been awarded the highly competitive Drug-Free Communities Grant by the CDC. On the phone to tell us what that means, I have the director of Communities That Care, Mary Krista Smith. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Happy holidays.
Yeah, you too. So tell us about the grant. It was applied for by the Park City Community Foundation on your behalf?
Correct. We are fiscally sponsored by the Park City Community Foundation. And so through that organization, we were able to apply for the grant. And we actually applied in April. So we have been waiting with bated breath and fingers crossed for a long time to receive the news that we were one of the few coalitions across the country that received the award. So we are delighted and thrilled and grateful to the Community Foundation for being the support that makes that happen.
Yeah, so how much was the grant for?
So the grant is for $125,000 a year in federal funding for substance use prevention work. And it is renewable for up to 10 years. So it potentially can bring over $1 million of federal dollars in prevention work efforts to our community.
All right. So you'd have to reapply, though, each year?
For the first 5 years, my understanding is as long as you are following your work plan and staying within your budget, it's you know, it'd be really hard to lose it in the first 5 years. And then at your sixth year, you have to, again, go through a competitive process where you are demonstrating sustainability when it comes to your coalition.
All right. So you mentioned it was for substance abuse prevention. I mean, to talk to me more about what that will look like then.
Yeah, so, you know, as a coalition, we are focused on collective impact. And so what that looks like is we review the SHARP data along with other school district and county level data about what's happening with our kids. And we target substances and the risk factors that are playing a part in youth. And the three substances we target are alcohol, marijuana and vaping, tobacco, if you will, through vaping. Those are the highest used substances by youth in Summit County. And then we look at the risk factors that underlie those, and those risk factors are parental attitudes favorable to substance use, community connectedness, as well as perceived risk. And then we go after those risk factors at a multitude of levels through all of our coalition members. So we have counselors, school district staff, local nonprofits, local government leaders, health department staff who sit on our coalition, and each of those organizations has a role to play and an influence point in working to address those risk factors with youth.
So you mentioned, I mean, they're going to want to see what they're getting for their money. What will you have to show?
So, you know, primarily what we want to show is a decrease in youth through the SHARP data study and through what kids are reporting. But we will also show the, you know, the various tactics of our work plan. So part of it is a public service campaign to educate folks about prevention science and brain science and those kinds of things. So we'll be able to demonstrate that we've completed that public awareness campaign. We hold prevention classes, both Communities That Care and our partners hold prevention classes for parents across the community. So we will, you know, be able to show we've held X number of classes over the course of the year with this kind of attendance and these types of follow-up assessments and surveys. So there's a whole multitude of ways in which we can show and demonstrate the impact of our plan.
So will you be hiring new staff then with the money to make this PR rollout happen?
I've been fortunate to have hired our very first staff besides me this year. Her name is Heather Curry, and she works on a contractual basis as our communications specialist, and that has been just a huge blessing in the ability to have the capacity to do the work. But within that work plan, and one of the things the DFC grant provides for is hiring additional support staff that can help us with program implementation, especially when it comes to equity and equality and diversity, making sure that all of our deliverables are culturally competent in Spanish, accessible and meaningful for our Latinx community, and so forth. So yes, a lot of things these days, Leslie, are happening online. So it's really important that we have robust support for our online platform. So all of that, fortunately, was written into the grant so that now we can expand that capacity even further. And I would just also say, not only for ourselves, but for all of our coalition partners who have been part of this effort from the beginning, it's designed to support them in their work as well.
Yeah, you told me it was a very highly competitive grant. Is that based just on the number of applicants looking for the money, or is it just the small number of grants that are actually awarded?
It's both. There are not a lot of grants out there that are in the social services sector, so that is part of the equation, but it's also the grant that community coalition, prevention coalitions like ours go for across the country. I remember when I was first hired with Communities That Care, and this is the third time that we've applied for it. It's foundational to how coalitions build their capacity. And in the state of Utah alone, there are over 100 prevention coalitions in our state. So only two were awarded it this year. So that gives you a little indication. And, you know, I think that our grant writer really helped us tell a compelling narrative about the demographics of Summit County, because for those people on the outside, they may think, oh, well, it's Park City and they're wealthy and they have all this money and they don't really need it. And I think it's a real testament to the story of our community that we have been able to demonstrate a more nuanced narrative that relates with not only our Latinx community in Park City and also economic disparities, but the rural nature of Eastern Summit County and the need for this kind of federal funding across our community, not just for Park City proper.
Yeah. So what do you think took you over to the winner's circle then? I mean, if being one of two.
I think there are a couple of things, Leslie. I think one is having the credibility and the foundation of the Community Foundation as the organization through which we were applying that carried a lot of weight in our narrative. I think the commitment of the various funding sources within our community, that the Health Department, Park City Municipal, Cats Amsterdam Foundation have been our primary funders, and to see that diversity amongst funding has been helpful. And I just have to give huge credit to our grant writer, who has written many, many federal grants for the CDC and has also been an evaluator. And so she really had the expertise to know what they were looking for in the application. And I give her tremendous credit for being able to help us put it together.
Well, congratulations. Anything else you'd like to tell us?
I'm just so excited. You know, when Communities That Care was first founded, it was a dream of a lot of people who've been working in this space for a very long time to bring a collective impact prevention coalition to our community. And we've grown, and we're about to take another quantum leap because of this funding. And I just want to give a lot of gratitude and credit to all the folks who've been working for years prior to this moment, who laid the foundation and the groundwork to make this happen.
Okay. Well, again, congratulations, Mary Krista. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a happy holidays.
Well, back in January, coming this January, Heber City residents will have a chance to give input on a massive waterline infrastructure project, which will cost about $80 million over the next 10 years. Since 2018, Heber City has had more than 100 waterline breaks, 90 of them occurring in the Old Town area. Heber City Manager Matt Brower says it's important to enact sewer and water fee increases beginning in February so they can start phasing in the project next year with a completion target of 2023. He says that there are 120 blocks of aging sewer lines that were installed before 1953.
And you see that the majority of the downtown sewer system is 70 years or older.
Horrocks Engineering has broken out the cost of replacing both water and sewer lines.
The cost for the sewer system replacement was about $45 million, and the cost for the water replacement was about $31 million. So it's a hefty price tag.
Brower wants the council to act quickly. In 2019, some homeowners experienced significant property damage.
We had five waterline breaks, five incidents that resulted in 13 claimants sustaining property damage. Heidi and Mayor and Wayne, you might recall me coming back before the city about a year and a half ago, wanting to help some of these property owners out. Some of these costs exceeded $30,000 and $40,000 of damage to these homes.
He has several goals in mind for the infrastructure project. One is to raise the rates slowly to avoid a rate revolt by the taxpayers. He says they want to finish it within a couple of years, and they want community support.
We want to address the most critical elements of Old Town infrastructure, the oldest sections and the most unreliable sections. We want to go after what we're calling a realistic project, meaning we don't want to bite off more than we can chew. We don't want to have a project that's too expensive, we can't afford it. And we don't want a project that is such a large scope that it becomes unmanageable and unwieldy, ultimately cost us more money. A project that allows us to manage the uncertainty, and this project will have a lot of uncertainty because all of it is underground in areas that we've not seen or even looked at for upwards of 70 years.
Brower says the rate increases are needed immediately beginning in February. He'll work over the next 6 to 8 months to document the water and sewer lines condition. Another rate increase would need to be put in place in August. For now, the Heber City Council plans to take public input at its January 5th meeting and will discuss it further when they meet for their annual retreat, also scheduled for next month.